Welcome to Versus History with Elliot Watson and Patrick O'Shaughnessy.
Good afternoon and welcome to Versus History. I am Dr. Elliot L. Watson, and with me is co-editor of Versus History, Patrick O'Shaughnessy. How are you, fella?
Good afternoon, Elliot. I'm very, very well. The sun is shining, although not too hot today. It's a beautiful day to be with you, to be here and to be talking about history.
Where are we? We're in Bahrain.
In Bahrain, yeah, enjoying ourselves, treating ourselves to a trawl through the vista of history.
All right. It's just about to be our weekend, is it not?
In about
an hour's time, we will be relaxing, and everybody else will still be at work. So that's quite nice.
I'm already relaxing.
All right. So, okay, Versus History. If you go to our website, www.versushistory.com, you'll notice that there is a blog there. And what Patrick and I do is we, as well as our contributors like Mike Towers, we write blogs on issues of interest to us, either disciplinary in terms of history skills, that kind of thing, or of topics that interest us. And one topic that has interested Patrick for quite a while now is King George III, and he has written a blog entry about it, and we thought we'd have a chat about that. Pat, why did you choose King George III to start with?
I love King George III.
You love King George?
Yeah, I always have. It was something that was never taught to me in school. We sort of went from the Tudors and the Armada to the Stuarts and the execution of Charles to the Levellers. We got to sort of the restoration of the monarchy and then the Glorious Revolution 1688. And then, you know, what we did?
What?
We jumped about 150 years to Queen Victoria and left the Georgians out.
So where did you first come across this guy then?
Well, I first came across him because I just read about him in school. I wondered where the 150 years went and why I was never taught him in Key Stage 3.
Right.
So the Georgians, they always have interested me, largely because it wasn't something we did in school. And my interest was perked because I hadn't done it in school, so I wanted to read about him. Then furthermore, I was also very, very interested in George III because, did you know, lots of our architecture in London and places like Edinburgh was built during the Georgian period.
Is that right?
Yeah, it certainly was. So Buckingham Palace, if you go to Edinburgh, most of that, the old town, is built during the Georgian period. And also the American Revolution. Been a big fan of learning about that for quite some time. And obviously that didn't happen on the Stuart's watch. That didn't happen on Victoria's watch. It happened somewhere in between, under the aegis of King George III. So I've always loved learning about the Georgians, largely because I didn't learn about it in school. It's something I could teach myself.
Okay.
And it's been so influential in everything that we are now, I suppose, in 2018 in Britain. Industrial Revolution, enclosure, exploration of the world, colonisation. It's so relevant now, but so undertaught.
Okay, well, before you go any further, just for those of us who might not know, when is this? When are we talking about?
We're talking in the 1700s. The Georgians came to power in 1714 after the death of Queen Anne. And there were no Stuart heirs, so they invited the Hanoverian electors to become kings of England. George I and George II were kings of England, but they weren't particularly popular. Probably one of the reasons why you don't see much architecture or statues in their honour. They didn't speak much English. They thought of themselves as Hanoverian first, probably, and British second. George I was on the receiving end of lots of taunts about being a turnip. The English didn't particularly take to him much. But George III was completely different. It's almost like a line was drawn in the sand. And George III, conversely, was loved.
Okay.
Oh, by and large.
Right. So King George is on the throne when some significant things happen in terms of the empire. Is that
empire
right?
And domestically. He takes power in 1760. He dies in 1820, although it's probably worth mentioning, from 1811 onwards, after the Regency Act, his son rules as Prince Regent, who was going to be far less popular, the subsequent George IV. Nowhere near as popular as his father.
Right.
So George III, he was one of Britain's most loved monarchs. He's certainly Britain's third longest reigning monarch after Victoria and Elizabeth II. But you're right to say lots of big things happened on his watch. We'll start domestically and then shall we span out?
Sure, sure, why not?
Okay,
sure.
Domestically we have enclosure. He was often known as the Farmer King. George III was so interesting for me because he was interested in stuff.
Oh.
He loved farming, he loved talking to farmers, but he was just at home writing essays. He wrote numerous essays on the art of kingship and how to be a good king, and furthermore, how to be a British king. English was his first language, unlike his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. He thought of himself as a British king first. In fact, he never even visited Hanover. He was the Elector of Hanover and then the King of Hanover, but he never even went there.
So when you say he was interested in farming, how did that manifest itself? Did he go to farms?
He
dealt with commoners?
He walked around in Windsor on his own, talking to farmers about farming, leaving them some money. He was really interested in essentially the substantive knowledge behind farming. Lots was happening in Britain about farming, which may be a tad less interesting to some, I don't know. Enclosure, the whole landscape of Britain was changing at that time.
What is enclosure?
Enclosure was essentially enclosing land, English land, with big hedges. So if you fly over England now on your way in or out, you know, from Heathrow Airport or whatever, Birmingham International, England looks like a patchwork quilt, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If you're outside of a city, it looks like sort of little plots of squared land.
And he was responsible for that? Is that what
he
you're saying?
He wasn't responsible for that, but he was very much interested in it, and it happened on his watch.
Okay,
so the landscape
right.
of Britain changes forevermore on his watch, and he was very interested in it. And he used to walk around Windsor saying hello to farmers, talking to them about farming, hence why he was known by some of his detractors as the Farmer King.
Huh.
But his interests did not stop there. I think it's key to mention he was a family man. He had 15 children.
Blimey.
He arranged his own marriage.
Who was his wife?
His wife was a lady called Charlotte. Charlotte in North Carolina is named after her. He was, by all accounts, completely loyal to her, which we know many other kings weren't loyal to their spouses. Henry VIII. So, he was very loyal. He loved his children. Now, he did fall out with some of them later on in his life, but he loved them so much that he used to measure them every month and write out their sequential measurements. So he took a great interest in his children's pastoral care and academic care.
When you say he used to measure them, measure their height. Right.
And, you know, he was very interested in bringing up children. He used to sign off his letters to his wife and his children, my dearly beloved. So he was a great man. And he was also very, very interesting. He loved things like astrology. He built, we didn't build it himself, on his watch in 1769. If you go to Greenwich Park, you'll see the Royal Observatory. He loved stars. He loved writing about science. He loved time. He loved maps. He was so interested in stuff. This was no sit back and kick back and chill monarch.
Was he a polymath? Was he capable, or was he just someone that had hobbies?
He was a polymath. I tell you why he was and why he was a good one, because academic literature hadn't advanced to the extent, that wasn't going to happen until 1800-ish, where you couldn't know about lots of stuff anymore because the academic literature was just too broad. In the 1760s, 70s and 80s, you could know about a lot of stuff. He had 65,000 books, much of which is now resident in the British Library. So he was genuinely interested in pretty much everything.
Wow.
And he was genuinely knowledgeable about pretty much most stuff, as far as the academic literature now tells us. So he was interested, and he was interesting. And also, I think we should mention, the Industrial Revolution really kicks off on his watch.
Sure. Now I'm a little bit ashamed to admit that, much like yourself, when I was at school, the Georgian period was not on the syllabus. Mm. I knew nothing about this royal family. And my first real introduction to King George III was in the film about 20 years ago called The Madness of King George. And that, I remember, was... It looked at his descent into madness, however that is characterised, whatever mental illness he did or did not have. But in the background, or the backdrop of it, was the conflict with America.
Yes. This is one of my gripes about King George. Not with King George, I love King George, but about King George. If you haven't studied the Georgians, then all you might know about King George is the moniker, or the pejorative, the Mad King.
Yeah.
Or all you might know about King George is the tyrant from the Declaration of Independence.
Yes.
You probably have heard, though, of King George via the Broadway musical Hamilton, which is an absolute smash hit.
Yes, it is.
We're talking $800, $900 for a ticket. We're talking every show a sellout, and we're talking an amazing musical, by the way.
Yeah, the album is best, however you describe it now, it is a bestseller. Is that what you just said?
It's almost as popular as the Versus History podcast, I think.
And the Versus History book, 33 Easy Ways to Improve Your History Essays. Carry on.
Shameless advertising, yeah. So that might be all you know of King George, the Mad King, the Bad King.
Yeah.
He made mistakes in America, or he allowed mistakes to be made on his watch. Did the revolution happen in America because of him? Probably not. Many of the Americans loved their king prior to the Declaration of Independence. In fact, George Washington fought for him in the French and Indian War / the Seven Years' War, and was still toasting to him well into the early 1770s. The Americans had a gripe with Parliament, and in fact, before the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Paine's pamphlet Common Sense, where he lambasts George, many Americans respected him and revered him and liked the idea of a monarchy. I would suggest that George inherits a revolutionary situation in 1760, even though it's still during the Seven Years' War and that's not over yet, because the seed has been sown of Enlightenment thinking, and the debt is mounting up, so ultimately taxation is going to have to be levied in America. I don't think the revolution was really his fault.
But what was his response to, let's say, the Declaration of Independence or the Continental Congress demanding things or refusing to obey Parliament and the Boston Tea Party? What was his response to these?
He thought if he acquiesced, this would be the end of the British Empire and they'd be consigned to being a third-rate power.
Oh, okay.
George, like many others in Britain, and also some in America, thought that Britain had paid a huge debt and a huge sum of money to protect the British settlers in North America from not only the Native Americans west of the Appalachians, but also from the French, and to defeat them. So he thought that a huge price had been paid by the British, that the Americans should pay their way. Yep. And furthermore, they were British subjects. Mm-hmm. So he was, I suppose you could say, quite truculent when it came to the war. He did not want to resign, and furthermore, he was the last to consent to separation. But he does say, when he meets the first US ambassador after the war, I think it was John Adams,
that's right,
he says, I was the last to consent to separation, but now separation having been agreed, I am the first to greet you in friendship. So I think that sums up George: warm, sincere, diligent, clever, and he was a good man at heart. Yes, he did some terrible things in America. He agreed that Hanoverian troops could be used. There were huge blunders made there. He certainly bullied Lord North into doing what he wanted. Mm. But ultimately, I think he was a good king.
Okay, well, I want to ask you this question. If you could sum up, in 30 seconds, the significance of George III, in whatever context you wish, how would you do it?
I'm going to go to 2018. I'm going to say, if you walk around central London, or if you go to Edinburgh, if you go to any town, you look at those Georgian buildings, you are going to see the legacy of George III living. If you've gone to any academic institution, primary school, secondary school, college, university, well, the love of learning was really imbued in British culture by King George III. He patronised it. He funded it. He loved it. He was so interesting because he was so interested in stuff. Not stuff via proxy, but stuff for stuff's sake. And he didn't mind transmitting that to people. He loved people. He loved his subjects. He wanted to be a British king, not a Hanoverian elector there by proxy. He was a good man, and the footprint of the Georgians is still there. Lots of the stuff that happened in Britain at the time wasn't due to him. We shouldn't conflate correlation with causation, but it happened on the Georgians' watch, and it was allowed to happen. And that's why I think the Georgians, them as a whole, were generally good for Britain, but George III in particular. If we are going to study one Georgian, it's probably going to be George III. He did fall out with his son, George IV. One of the reasons why George IV, the Prince Regent, built the Pavilion in Brighton, his interpretation of Asiatic culture, so it was like a mishmash of Indian, Arabic, Chinese. I went round it last summer. George IV detested his father, and by the end, George III had no time for his son. That was probably the one big black spot they really fell out.
Okay.
But as we know, George IV took over as regent between 1811 and 1820, and then was subsequent George IV, who was far, far less popular with the British people after his antics and his affairs and his falling out with his wife. So it was really a high point for monarchy. It was a low point, I suppose, in terms of losing America, but so much happened that we're not aware of. And if all we're going to take about George III is mental illness and the losing of America, that would be reductive, I think.
Okay. Well, that is fantastic. There's a lot of food for thought there, and a subject I'm certainly going to read more about. So thank you very much for that, Pat.
Pleasure, pleasure.
So I think we'll draw this to a close now. Okay, this is goodbye from me, Elliot, at Versus History, and it's goodbye from Pat.
Goodbye from me. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. All the best.
Thank you for downloading and listening to this edition of Versus History. Subscribe, visit us at our website, www.versushistory.com.